Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you on this Tuesday, the 19th of January. Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, following Friday's attack in Ouagadougou, Mali offers to help Burkina Faso fight Islamist militants.
Mali has dealt with a terrorist threat for a few years, but its military has not been up to scratch. In Burkina Faso, it might be a little better because they have a better organized military, but the financial means to deal with a constant terrorist threat are not there.
And authorities in Nigeria say 55 people, including government ministers, stole $6.8 billion under the previous administration.
What is rather surprised is the figure involved. It's such a whooping sum.
Stay tuned to those stories and more.
Top story.
Mali has vowed to help Burkina Faso tackle Islamist militants after a hotel attack in Ouagadougou. Meanwhile, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb said the Mali-based jihadist group Al-Murabitoun was behind the attack that left up to 32 people dead, mostly foreigners. The gunman attacked Splendid Hotel and Cappuccino Cafe restaurant in Ouagadougou on Friday. DW's Bram Postumus is in the capital and he told my colleague Eunice Wanjuru what the mood was like there.
It's actually remarkably normal when you go about town. The market is in full swing, the central market, which is not very far from where this attack took place. People are going about their business. There is obviously one very striking detail, which is that all the flags are at half mast because national mourning has been declared by President Kabore for 3 days. But and obviously, yes, the site of the attack, the big Kwame Nkrumah Avenue, right in the center of Ouagadougou, remains off limits for the most part because there is a big inquiry going on in exactly what happened.
So can we say that the security measures are being seen also throughout the city, or is it just around the hotel where the attack took place?
Well, for the time being, most visibly, yes, it is around the area where the attack took place. Obviously, for the rest of the city and indeed for the country, the curfew has been extended and is still in force. And it starts at 23 hours in the evening, 11 p.m., and it goes on until 6 a.m. We don't know how long this is going to last for, but that curfew in place to make sure that security is enhanced.
So two suspects were still at large by Sunday. Is there any development so far?
So far, to the best of my knowledge, no new developments. There is a bit of confusion about how many there were involved in this attack. The movement that has claimed responsibility, the Al-Murabitoun movement, which is basically based in Mali, has made public a picture of three of the assailants, which they say belongs to their movement. Yes, there is indeed still talk about a fourth suspect who was supposedly holed up in the adjacent Hotel Yiwi, which is just across the road from the Splendid Hotel that was attacked. That person was supposedly apprehended. So we're looking at one, maybe two people who supposedly are still at large.
And have all the victims been identified so far?
All but seven at last count. We now know that the authorities have made public the figure of 29. That includes these three terrorists that we talked about earlier, six Canadians, and there are also French, Portuguese, Dutch, and Ukrainian nationals, and obviously a lot of Burkinabe who are working in and around either the hotel or the bars that were attacked. So of those 29, we now have 22 names and seven remain to be identified.
Bram Postumus in Ouagadougou. To analyse developments following the attack, Eunice then spoke to Imad Mosdoua, political risk analyst for North and West Africa at Africa Matters. She asked him first the extent to which cooperation between Burkina Faso and Mali, which has just been announced, could counter threats of terrorist attacks.
Well, I think it's an important and necessary first step. One of the key problems the region has faced, countries in the region have faced in the past few years in dealing with the terrorist threat has been actually cooperating at a security level. Although there are a number of entities that have been set up, you know, such as the CEMOC or G5 in the Sahel, a number of organizations, regional organizations that have been set up to try to put into place this military cooperation, none of them have truly been as effective as is required to fight the necessary threat. So this is an important first step, and it remains to be seen what the details of the cooperation will be like. But it's important that there is at least political will backing military efforts to cooperate.
The Ouagadougou attacks come almost 2 months after the attack in Mali, which targeted foreigners. What could be the reasons why the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb militants are targeting foreigners in West Africa?
A lot of that has to do with the organization trying to, first of all, ramp up its profile in the region, both from a media point of view and also from an operational point of view. There is, to some certain extent, an element of competition with the Islamic State because that organization is growing in strength in North Africa, in Libya, and also in West Africa, in Nigeria. So really, it's an organization, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, is trying to grow and trying to cement its position, its already strong position in the Sahel, so that it doesn't lose its followership.
So do the two West African nations have the capacity to fight terrorism?
Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly there's some expertise in terms of the experience that they've had. Mali has dealt with a terrorist threat for a few years, but its military has not been up to scratch in terms of the capacity that it has, the financial capability, the know-how. You'll remember that the central state of Mali was almost overrun by jihadis coming from the north, and that Mali required assistance from the French with Operation Serval. In Burkina Faso, I think the capacity is not all too dissimilar. It might be a little better because they have a better organized military, but the financial means to deal with a constant terrorist threat are not there, and neither is the know-how. What's kept the country safe for so long were, in some ways, the connections that the previous president, Blaise Compaoré, who was overthrown in a revolution, he had connections through, you know, third parties and intermediaries with some of the terrorist groups in the region. And as a result of him playing the role of mediator, he was able to keep them away from attacking Burkina Faso.
What does the Friday attack mean politically for Burkina Faso and President Kabore, who is only 2 months into office?
Well, I think it's a very testing time for President Kabore and for his new prime minister and newly appointed cabinet. Certainly a baptism of fire for them because they're having to deal with a major security threat now all of a sudden, you know, when they've only just taken office. Their primary challenge, I think, is to ensure that the terrorist threat and terrorist attacks are unable to destabilize the state and unable to destabilize the unity of the state and its institutions and of its people.
Imad Mastua, political risk analyst at Africa Matters.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Nigeria's information minister, Lai Mohammed, said on Monday that 55 people, including former governors, cabinet ministers and government workers, stole $6.8 billion from Nigeria's treasury between 2006 and 2013. Mohammed made the allegations while launching a national sensitization campaign appealing to Nigerians to join the fight against corruption. Now, the money, the minister said, could have built 36 hospitals or educated 4,000 children through to university. He did not identify the 55. I asked our correspondent in Abuja, Ben Shemang, whether the announcement of this large-scale theft had come as a shock to many Nigerians.
Honestly, it is not a kind of a shock at all to many Nigerians, because there are quite a lot of people who are going trial right now. We're talking of former governors. Yes, they have been tried. Some have been detained. We're talking of former ministers. Some have been tried and been detained. And we're talking of some security officers that have been jailed too. So it's really not a surprise. What is rather a surprise is the figure involved. It's such a whooping sum.
How corrupt do people think that President Goodluck Jonathan's government actually was?
these revelations are coming and are actually showing that the government of President Goodluck Jonathan was indeed very, very corrupt. Bearing in mind that there have been a lot of projects that have been abandoned. And year in, year out, there have always been appropriations. For example, there is this road from Abuja to Kogi State in Lokoja, so to speak. This road is just about 200 kilometers. But up to now, for about 7 years, there are always appropriations. This road has not been completed. The same thing with the railway system from Kaduna into Abuja. It's a new rail track. Nothing, it's not been completed. Yet year in, year out, appropriations are done. If you check the electricity in this country, Nigeria, a population of about 170 million people, we are battling with just over 3,000 megawatts of electricity. Yet every year money was appropriated to generate and distribute electricity. Nothing is working.
Can you see this national sensitization campaign working, given the fact that corruption is so rampant in Nigeria?
It's going to work, Mark. It's about reorientation. People should now do the correcting. People should now see corruption, abhor it, see it as an abnormality. And I think that Nigerians will welcome it so much in that just a few people have hijacked this country and taken the commonwealth of Nigerians into private pockets.
Ben Shimang in Abuja.
Africa on the move.
In recent years, Ghanaian farmers have turned to cashew farming. This came after experts predicted that cashew has greater potential as a source of foreign revenue than Ghanaian cocoa. However, the price which farmers receive for their crop is determined by Indian buying agents. The farmers feel the government should regulate cashew prices, much as it regulates the price of cocoa. The farmers also face a variety of other risks, as Maxwell Souk reports.
The sun is about to set and farmer Edmond Ajiman is collecting his cashew nuts back into the room. The 70-year-old has been growing cashew crops in the last 20 years and says he makes his living on it.
Actually, it has aided me in my fundraising. I have many children. If not this farm, I couldn't have been caring for them in their education. And moreover, it feeds me and others. It clothes me. So it helps me in my monetary affairs.
Cashew is an emerging non-traditional cash crop in Ghana, and many farmers are going into cashew farming. It has the potential to overcome the Ghanaian cocoa in terms of generating foreign income, says Emmanuel Owusu, an agricultural officer in Sampa, Brown Ahafo region.
If you look at the benefit we are getting as of now, talking of the gross domestic product of Ghana, income to peasant farmers and the processors and the exporters, and look at the workload on cashew, harvesting, picking, and drying doesn't take much time. So if you compare all these activities to what is done in cocoa, cashew has more potential than cocoa.
But the cashew farming sector is threatened by bush fires, according to farmer Ajiman.
When you have the farm and it burns, it keeps you about 3 steps back. So in fact, fire have been destroying our farms because you have to nurse them back.
The Ghanaian cashew farmers feel neglected by the government. They want him to regulate cashew marketing as it is done to cocoa. Ajiman again.
We are not happy at all. We are being cheated. When they come normal, they determine the price because they think we can't chew them.
The farmer is referring to the Indian buying companies and the local agents who set their prices based on various issues, including quality specifications and world market price. Besides the cashew nuts, Ghana produces a lot of fruits which can be turned into juice for consumption, but the local market is flooded with foreign juices. Edna Kudalo owns the Eurofra Fruit Processing Company, and she is worried over the influx of foreign juice products on the Ghanaian market.
The influx of the foreign Jews into the market is 80%, and we have only 20%. If you have 50%, we're creating jobs, we're bringing money. Instead of people looking for foreign exchange to go out and bring the Jews into the market. And the Jews that come in are not of high quality.
Edina and her fruit juice producing colleagues now want government intervention by stopping the influx of foreign fruit juices into the country. James Asareje, president of the Association of Ghana Industries, says the situation is worrying.
Why should we import tilapia? That is fish. Why should we import plantain? Why should we import? I mean, even some key, some things that can be produced locally, rice, cooking oil, tomatoes, and so many other things.
There is an ongoing campaign to encourage Ghanaians to consume made-in-Ghana products. However, this drive is threatened by the lingering taste of foreign products.
Maxwell Souk with that report. In Kenya, a new law has been proposed by the Attorney General to regulate the registration of churches and certain religious practices in the country. Religious leaders have expressed deep concern and anger at the proposed new rules, which the authorities say are an attempt to clamp down on fake preachers. James Shimanyula reports.
The new regulatory religious rules published by Kenya's Attorney General include stipulation that Christian preachers in Kenya must hold theological certificates from accredited theological institution, and that religious organizations must be registered and open to the registrar's inspection. Philip Wanyolo, chairman of the Kenya Conference of Catholic Bishops, briefly reflects on the impact of the new rules on his church with more than 14 million baptized faithful.
It is with shock and surprise that the government has formulated new rules that, if implemented, will have direct and negative impact on our evangelization mission. The Constitution of Kenya draws a very clear line between the state and religion. The Constitution is also explicitly clear on the freedom of worship. How then, we ask, does the government purport to regulate how Kenyans worship? Is this not a clear violation of the Constitution?
Bishop Mark Kariuki of the Kenya Pentecostal Church contends that the new rules are geared at persecuting Christians.
It is clear that the church is being persecuted. It is clear that it is under attack. In Kenya, the church is under attack.
But Reverend Sammy Wainaina of the Anglican Church of Kenya differs with his two colleagues.
I would support regulation so that we work within a framework. And this should affect all religious groups, churches, mosques and others, and also NGOs. Because we serve the public and we need to be responsible to the public.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta asserts that the new rules will help weed out rogue preachers.
We have a few people whose work is to illegally obtain money from citizens. Their false message to the citizens is that they are spreading gospel or the word of God, but they enrich and enrich themselves from the sweat of the citizens. We have to help each other to find ways of weeding these false preachers from our society, because they are not preachers. They are thieves.
The rules also apply to Christian preachers who deliver live sermons on radio and television and ask for offertory in exchange for what they describe as special prayers and blessing. I joined hundreds of Catholic faithful at a church service on the outskirts of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Their views revolved around a section of the proposed rules that ban offertory.
To give so that you have to be blessed, because it's a part of worshiping when you give.
The government should not in any way interfere with the church affairs. That's my point. That's my position, man.
We have to give the offertory because it's God in the church.
We will not allow a few individuals to guard the church by enacting rules that are going against the constitution and the laws of this nation.
It comes from your own heart.
And that report was compiled by James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
Making a difference.
And in Making a Difference this week, we meet a 62-year-old Sierra Leonean who has designed a motorcycle ambulance. The idea came when the West African country was wrestling with the Ebola epidemic. More than 3,500 people died of Ebola in Sierra Leone, and one contributory factor to this high death toll was the lack of a rapid means of transport which could ferry patients to medical centres in good time. This report now from Mutala Kamara.
This is a motorcycle ambulance designed and constructed here in Sierra Leone by Finic.
The motorcycle ambulance is the innovation of Fode Melvin Kamara, founder of Fomel Industry and National Industrialization Center, Finic. The 62-year-old German-trained automobile engineer and entrepreneur designed the motorcycle ambulance at the height of the Ebola outbreak. He wanted to help stop the spread of the Ebola virus. At the time, only 35 ambulances were available to take patients to medical centers for a population of more than 6 million. Governments around the world donated ambulances to Sierra Leone in response to the Ebola epidemic, but the ambulances were said to be gathering dust in a warehouse. Dozens more stand idle in car parks around the country.
This ambulance can operates in areas where a conventional ambulance can operate. Conventional ambulance, one of it can fetch 20 of these ambulances, meaning this can have a greater impact than the conventional ambulance.
Fitted with removable stretcher, the motorcycle ambulance allows a patient to lie down in comfort. It is also equipped with a siren and beacon light. Kamara identified the need but lacked support. He regrets that his product could have saved many lives in Sierra Leone.
If government was to utilize this ambulance, they would have created more impact. More deaths would have been avoided if this ambulance was used.
Even though his innovation could not be fully utilized to fight the Ebola virus, Melvin Kamara has been approached by an organization that wants to use the ambulances to transport pregnant women to medical centers. The hope is to reduce high infant mortality rate in the country. His innovation have earned him recognition. He was awarded the Order of the Rocaille, Sierra Leone's highest honor. He says despite the honor, challenges still exist. He has managed to pass on skills to many young Sierra Leoneans from the time he started operating in 1997. He currently has 35 trainees that he says are performing well.
I received further training in the Federal Republic of Germany in the field of automobile engineering. But when I came back, I realized that the motor vehicle is well served. Almost every street corner has a repair garage. So I said to myself, look, I can reschool myself and become a mechanical engineer to be designing and manufacturing machines.
Kamara believes it is important to train young people in technical skills to secure the future of the country.
Mutala Kamara in Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Harare, Nairobi, or Abuja, Africa Link's correspondents bring Africa's stories to you.
A reminder of some of those stories. Burkina Faso and Mali are to cooperate in the fight against Islamist militants. Authorities in Nigeria say 55 people, including government ministers, stole $6.8 billion over a seven-year period under the previous administration. And we've also been hearing about a motorcycle ambulance designed in Sierra Leone. A reminder, we welcome your comments on this programme, either by text message to country code 49160957595910, by email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or by letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. From me, Mark Caldwell, thank you for listening and bye now.